The title of this sermon is Jesus the Man. If it were Jesus, Son of God, what I would say would probably be predictable. What I am about to say, I think, will be much less so. I will say some things to you that thousands and thousands of ministers all over this country learn in seminary, but which most of them think it is not particularly wise to pass on to congregations. They may be right. Listen carefully, listen critically, and know that it is never expected of anyone in this room that there be agreement with what is said in this pulpit. If you were here last week, you heard some comments about what Jesus of Galilee may have looked like, along with a confession that we haven't the slightest idea what he looked like, except that it almost certainly wasn't anything like those romanticized pictures we see on Sunday school cards and in famous paintings. We are so captivated by his life and thought that we just make those up, unable to imagine a physique anything less than Hollywood perfect. No one likes to face the possibility, and I have tested this, that Jesus might have had uneven teeth and a slight squint in one eye, that he might have stood only 5'2" and walked with a limp from a childhood accident. Moral perfection, we would like to believe, must mean physical perfection as well. I mention these things so that when you realize how we have sanitized and glorified the image of the physical Jesus, you can begin to understand how his adoring disciples may have glorified and expanded some of the stories of his life when they began to write about a generation or two after his death. The point is that not only do we have no idea what he looked like, but we can't be sure about quite a number of other things. How he talked, for example. If we had only Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we might have a fairly consistent picture of his vocabulary and his general way of making sentences and paragraphs, and how he handled imagery and ideas. But then along comes the gospel according to John, and everything changes. In the first three gospels, the speeches of Jesus are short, concrete, highly poetic, filled with little short stories that we call parables, and lots of illustrations from life around home and on the farm. But in John's gospel, the speeches are long and abstract, with a much more theological kind of vocabulary, different rhythms, different styles. You can test this, if you care enough, very easily this very afternoon. Since John's gospel was probably written quite a long time after the others, it probably represents Jesus talking as some in the early church felt the Son of God would have talked. But we can't really be sure why the Jesus of John is so different from the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Just as we can't be sure about even some of the simplest vital statistics. We don't know the date of his birth or the date of his death, except within a range of a few years. Even the place of his birth is in question. Two of the four Gospels have no interest in that birth at all and don't talk about it. Matthew and Luke have him born in Bethlehem, but if you study those stories carefully, it looks as if they are both shaping history so that Jesus will fulfill the ancient Jewish promise that the Messiah would be born where the great King David was born, in Bethlehem. It seems more likely that he was born in Nazareth, although I choose to forget about that on Christmas Eve while I'm listening to one of my favorite nativity songs, O Little Town of Bethlehem. But you deserve to know, you are the kind of audience that deserves to know, as does any student today in a good seminary, that Bethlehem, as a birthplace, is probably the poetry of adoration and expectation and not the sober fact of history. History doesn't always perform the way we would like. Sometimes, for the sake of symbolism, we have to change it. People talk loosely, it seems to me, about the divinity of Jesus, so that it isn't always clear what they mean. If it means equating Jesus with God, then the New Testament often seems to contradict it. Jesus prayed to God, not to himself. He agonized over how to know and carry out the will of God as we do. God does not use the language of Jesus, who says, "If it be possible," the language very clearly of someone who is not all-powerful or even all-knowing, "if it be possible." In the earliest of the Gospels, Jesus rebukes some adoring disciples by saying, "Why do you call me good? There is none good but God." A clear denial that he should be equated with God. But he was unique. A Roman centurion, awed by the power of Christ's life, as I have been all of my life, watched him as he took his final breath and said, in the best manuscripts, "Truly this man was a son of God." But we too are sons and daughters of God. And unless it is possible for us to have power available to Jesus, then the command to be like him is useless and cruel. Whatever it may mean to speak of the divinity of Jesus, it cannot mean, it must never mean, that he was not truly and literally a human being. He got tired, hungry, thirsty, he was happy and sad and fearful. He claimed to be surprised by the faith of a Roman soldier, Now, either this is a trick, and he was not really surprised at all, or this means he did not know everything. Because if you know everything, as God is said to know everything, then nothing can surprise you. But of course, Jesus never claimed to know everything. And once, in answer to a question, he said, "I don't know. I don't know this. Only God knows this." Sometimes this very real person was full of confidence and joy, sure that the kingdom would arrive in glory and splendor in a matter of months. Sometimes he was depressed enough to say, "I am so sad, I could almost die." If you're a little shocked to hear it that way, let me digress just long enough to remind you of something. You're used to reading the staid and elegant language of the King James Version, in which Jesus is quoted as saying, "I am sorrowful even unto death." But he didn't use that kind of elegant language. He used Koine Greek, street Greek, colloquial Greek. What he said was, "I am so sad, I could almost die." We're told in the first of Luke's gospel that as a child, he grew in knowledge and in favor with God. Are you hearing that? One cannot grow who is already fully grown. One cannot increase knowledge who already knows everything. One cannot grow in favor with God who is already God Himself. We need to recapture the genuine humanity of Jesus. We need to see a schoolboy sitting on the floor with the boys he played with after school, reciting his lessons, playing childish pranks. Whatever it means to call him divine, it cannot mean that he was not truly human. You may or may not know this, but the church had to fight hard in its early years to keep him human. There was an early heresy called Docetism that almost tore the church apart, and it concerned just who Jesus was. You might naturally suppose that these Docetists must have doubted the divinity of Jesus. But it was the other way around. They doubted his humanity. They said he was God, but not man. They said he only appeared to have a body of flesh and blood, able to suffer and die. It was part of that spiral of elevation and adoration that finally could not even admit the humanity of Jesus. And the church itself fought these Docetists and drove them out because it was the church early on that insisted on the true humanity of Jesus. So what caused this temptation to turn Jesus into God? The answer, I think, is that as his first friends looked at him, and some later on tried to imagine him, the feeling was that this man expressed more perfectly than anyone had ever done before the nature of God. They said to themselves, "We have never seen so much of God poured into one human life. So much transcendent goodness is here. So great a moral challenge to the rest of us that this man is God's son as no one else has ever been." So in those early disciples of Jesus, there grew a sense of his authority over lives. Not the authority of regimentation, trying to make everybody alike, but the authority of a role model, so that in his presence, both men and women found themselves lifted above their normal behavior. They would say at first, God sent him, but it would not be enough. And after a time, they would say, God is with him. But even that would become inadequate to express their devotion. And they would begin to say, God came in him. The human and divine are not so separated, after all, that God cannot visit us. The very mind of God has taken on human flesh and has dwelt among us. Later, as the church wrote about these things, it wrapped more and more of the miraculous around the person of Jesus, partly to convince the unbelieving world of his greatness and power, since that world had not experienced them. The virgin birth story, which apparently came along a little late in early Christian history, was meant to do this. But it has always puzzled careful students, because it traces the descent of Jesus through the flesh, as if the divinity of Jesus were physical rather than spiritual. And it has puzzled careful students because Jesus himself never offered so much as a hint that his birth was different, even when it would have helped a great deal to have done so. The two writers in the New Testament who most strongly talked about the holiness and the goodness and the greatness of Jesus were John and Paul, and neither of them, directly or indirectly, wrote of a miraculous birth. But if they ignored the birth stories, they were both nevertheless intoxicated by the idea that the life of Jesus shows what life can be when the divine is released through it. And that is exactly the promise Jesus made to us. You can, by the power of your faith, he said, become sons and daughters of God. We play it down, this idea that we can be sons and daughters of God, because, quite frankly, it frightens us. We want to be a little good, but not so greatly good that it might take over and mess up our chances of succeeding, of protecting our interests. If our children, I have seen this many times, if our children threaten to get too idealistic, too close to the nature of that extraordinary human being, it scares us. A Mother Teresa is okay on the streets of Calcutta. We're not sure we could handle that much sheer devotion in our own household. But such lives of absolute devotion do come along, as Jesus predicted they would when he said, take up your cross and follow me. If he is not truly human, so that we who are human can actually do this, then those words are a cruel joke. something like Michael Jordan saying to a victim of cerebral palsy, "Come on now, do it the way I do it," and slam dunk the basketball. We must have within ourselves the power to be like Christ, or all the admonitions to imitate Him are meaningless. The divinity of Jesus simply cannot mean that He only pretended to be genuinely human, that He feigned His tears and His surprise and His anger, that the agony in the Garden of Gethsemane was fraudulent, because He knew all the time He could slip into a phone booth, peel off the dusty toga, and become super God. Beyond fear, beyond pain, beyond the perils of mortality. You might try imagining what you would do if you were asked to prepare a eulogy for someone you once knew, or perhaps never knew at all, but had heard about, who had been dead at least 30 years, who occupied almost no space at all in public records, who lived only in the recollections of his friends and admirers and enemies, and since you admire the person, you have little interest in what his enemies thought. So you ask for stories, for memories of his conversations. You arrange these in the way you think best, probably with the chronology and the geography a little uncertain, and you present your hero in the best possible light. And you would, in fact, end up with exactly the kind of memorial eulogies the four Gospels give us. If you do not know how much they differ, you have not analyzed them with great care. Let me give you an example from history how this kind of thing works. Socrates was eulogized by three Greek writers. Socrates and Christ had this in common, that neither of them apparently ever wrote a word. They were only written about. They left no personal records. Three Greek writers eulogized Socrates. All of them knew him personally. They give us three different persons, so that we have, in classical scholarship, the riddle of the real Socrates. It's very much like that with Jesus. Mark writes first. Matthew and Luke make their own sketches with Mark in front of them, omitting a few details now and then, adding others here and there which are not in Mark, reflecting in their finished work their own slightly different reasons for writing. Still another writer, John, is so different from them in how he presents Jesus that one great New Testament scholar says the Gospel of John is 90% different from the other three. Question: did any of these disciples of Jesus, as his actual life faded from view, ever embellish his life to justify their founding a church in his name? If not, they would have been the first and last in history who did not expand on the merits of their hero. Does it ever strike you as odd that if Jesus did all the stupendous miracles the church told about later, neither the Jews nor the Romans, who wanted to accomplish his death, ever showed any fear that he might miraculously keep them from doing it? Is it any comfort to some of you that a giant like Rudolf Bultmann, generally a skeptic, could say of Jesus that in one man the possibilities of human existence were fully realized? I know that isn't enough for many who must have an extraterrestrial, a miracle worker, a divine alien, so far beyond our comprehension that we never imagine for a moment that we might be truly like him. But for other great Christians in history, it has made sense. For me, of all the tributes I have read, I like best the one with which Albert Schweitzer closes his unparalleled book about Jesus. Albert Schweitzer, who for my money comes closer to the imitation of Christ than anyone in this century. Listen carefully, and then do what you're always invited to do with sermons from this pulpit. Use what you can, and if you must throw some things away, be glad that for a few minutes they challenged your mind and made you ask, what do I really believe? Here is Schweitzer's magnificent final word on Jesus the man. But such a man that Schweitzer capitalizes every pronoun, such a man that Schweitzer gave up fame and fortune to obey him. Schweitzer says he comes to us as one unknown. As of old, by the lakeside, he came to those who knew him not. He speaks to us the same word, follow me, and sets us to the task which he has to fulfill for our time. He commands, and to those who obey him, whether they be wise or simple, he will reveal himself in the toils, the conflicts, the sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship. And as an ineffable mystery, they shall learn in their own experience who he is. In their own experience. Because finally, sermons or not, there is no other way.